Chapter 3. The winter was pleasant, much better than Ireland, Blade thought. Hispana felt like God's land as the army regrouped and mended from the last campaign. Troops cheered when the king's commander announced they would be relieved and returned to England after one last liberating sweep on the plains of Morto el Polvo, 50 leagues south. This last skirmish was expected to be of small consequence compared to their last great victory before winter camp. Rumors were rampant. The Knights of St. John held Malta. The Ottoman Empire was stalled by God's blow. The Turkish Sultan, Suleiman the Magnificent, was stalemated at Rhodes by the miracle knights blessed by God. Indeed, the legends of Jean Parisseau de la Vallée, the Grand Master, inspired all fighting under the cross. All hail Charlemagne! But now, with relations strained between Catholic Spain and Protestant England, it was time to return home. Let the Spanish deal with the Turks. England's forces would return victorious and proud. Spirits were high. Blade no longer remembered his home. 9 Earth's turns had passed, and fighting was all he knew. He wondered what would happen after the crusade. What work would he do? Where would he live? Shortly after arriving at winter camp, he was summoned to the commander's tent to evaluate his injury. His heel mended but left a permanent limp that stilled him from marching to the tune of the battle drums. He stood, worried, still on crutches before 4 king's knights who would decide his fate. He knew seriously wounded men no longer fit were cashiered to find their own way home. A fast conference and vote decided that Blade, because of his legend reputation, would be assigned to the archers of the King's Guard to train with the longbow. Disappointed, Blade understood he could fight no more with his foot soldiers and decided to give it his best. After the first day, he looked forward to the training, and a moon later, off the crutches, he proved he had a good eye, backed up by long, strong arms and shoulders. Blade was determined, worked hard, and after 2 moons was most good as their best. After a few sun's turns, he noticed the men spent all their training with the bow, ignoring their other weapon, the halberd. If ever overrun by cavalry, this horse-long pole with a spike and cleaving blade could save their life. So he decided to teach them the finer points of its use. With his fighting reputation, in a half moon, confidence and morale was bettered. The master bowman observed Blade's action with favor. One early morn at the ending time of winter camp, Blade was awakened by a dream. His mind conjured a stronger bow designed to shoot further than any other. Hustling up, he went off alone with a sack of food, water, tools, a couple of longbows, and a handful of flight arrows. He selected the bows from the best yew from the north, rather than beech or elm, and the longest ash arrows crafted by the bowmen of Cheshire. After finishing a full moon of practice, he preferred bowstrings of flax over linen and took an extra length. Alone, on a silent hill overlooking the valley, he watched the yellow sun creep over the distant plain as the smell of peat drifting on the breeze announced a rich dawn. Taking a deep breath, he settled under the shade of a wide oak, enjoying the beauty of the valley. Looking aloft at the clear sky, he noticed a morning hawk circling, sailing slow on the wind, shopping for the best to eat. As he watching curious, the hawk suddenly seemed to stop in the air, staring at him. At that moment, Thomas felt a force surge through his body. A special kinship connected his spirit with the hawk. He shivered, welcoming the brotherhood as he watched the hawk vanish in the glare of the sun. Thomas, feeling renewed, wondered the meaning of what occurred. Finally deciding it was beyond him, back to the present, he bent to his task. He first placed the 2 bow staves side by side, but separated in the middle by a hand-sized length of wood, a knuckle wide. Then he laced the two bows together from top to bottom with thin-cut leather. Next, he strung both bows with the two flax bowstrings and with another strip wound the strings together, a hand's length long in the center. Finished, he held a single fat bow, extra wide, with a gap between the two staves capable of resting an arrow. Now, to see if it works. Sitting down, he placed his feet on each side of the staves, knocked the arrow, rolled on his back, and pulled the bowstring with both hands, full back. The tension, hard and tight, used most of his arm and leg strength, but it pulled smooth, allowing the arrow to be stretched fully to the barbed arrowhead. Releasing with a strumming twang, the arrow shot forward, double the force, and disappeared from sight. Frowning, he realized a problem. It was no good shooting an arrow so far if one could not be accurate. Taking a rest, he plopped on the cushion of cool grass, pondering the problem as he absently watched swollen clouds pass by. If only he could shoot arrows at the same angle and the same power every time, he mulled. It was known the length of arrow pull against a tested bow set the distance, but how does one keep the arch the same for every shot? Blade jumped up. He had an idea. Excited now, he cut four straight branches waist high, about a finger round. He measured, cut, and stuck two sticks in the soft dirt, and taking another, laced it to one, allowing it to slide up and down. The fourth was tied across the tops of both, ending with a stick more or less horizontal to the ground. But by sliding the two laced side by side, either up or down, he could change the angle of the horizontal stick. Now the trick was to line up the arrows to match the chosen angle of the stick before shooting. With a little practice and a good eye, he figured the arrow should drop just about the same place every time. Now let's see how this works. Blade shot five arrows at the angle of his device and walked forward to see where they landed. After some distance, much further than the normal bow, he searched around but couldn't find them. Looking around, puzzled, wondering their fate, he glanced further and spotted some sticks poking up through the grass. Trotting over, he laughed aloud, finding the arrows grouped within three arms of each other, at least 2 furlongs from the spot he loosed them. The next sun was an exciting time. Blade demonstrated his double bow and his target guide to the night commanders, the archers, and anyone else who wanted to watch. "I have never witnessed such a feat," the commander said. The expression of the others said the same. "Your name, Bowman?" he asked. "Thomas." "Sir Knight." "Your Christian name?" "Thomas Michael Fallon," he answered, standing tall. "Well, Thomas Michael Fallon, you be Irish then, eh?" the commander said, noting his pride. "Aye, sir." Thomas stood straighter. "I am told you are also named Blade among the men. Why is that?" Blade blushed slightly as the knight bowman spoke up. "Because of his prowess with two swords, my lord. He was the best swordsman in infantry." "Ah, yes. Now I recall." He turned to Blade and stilled, making a quick study. "Well, Blade, known as Thomas Michael Fallon, your feat here today warrants recognition. As of today, you will be your knight squire and train our archers with your new bow." The task started immediately. Fashioning the bows and crafting the new target guides, now made of metal, able to fold and portable. The complete unit was pressed into service to complete the job, and although all was on schedule, supervising the effort left Blade exhausted with a few hours' sleep each night. At the next moon's turn, the Crusaders prepared to break camp. When scouts reported a large infidel army moving toward them a quarter moon out, they judged the horde at 30,000 strong, with animals big as 10 horses pressing the march without cannon, scorching the land before them. The scouts, wide-eyed, described beasts with long noses that touched the ground and ears big as wagon wheels. Most had armored baskets strapped to their backs, holding four archers, and were supported by horse cavalry too thick to count. This was dire news, and an immediate war council was called. Blake attended because of his new position as squire, but stood quiet in the rear of the command tent. One knight after another proposed various courses of action, and after much debate, two conclusions were drawn. The first, to stay and fight, would result in defeat, but their valor would be remembered. Second, to retreat and possibly escape, returning to England in shame. The room quieted as all contemplated the choices. How would their great army fare if they had no commanders? Blade thought aloud from the back of the tent. Everyone turned and stared, some dismissing him, others thinking his question foolish, the rest angry that one in his position dared to speak. Blade blushed. What is your aim, Blade? The king's commander asked. The answer is clear. The army would panic and rout. Blade cleared his throat. With your leave, Sir Knight, I have an idea to kill all or most of their greater commanders before they attack. As you say, without their leaders, they will be confused and panic. Speak up, lad, he said with some reservation. Lay out your plan so we may decide its merit. Nervous, Blade, feeling every eye, pushed his way to the map table. Using the tip of his bow as a pointer, he cleared his throat. Sir, if we keep our camp where we are, the infidels can only attack across the open plain because of the steep hill behind and on our flanks. The devils, knowing our strength, will be arrogant in their expected victory. Blade became more confident, pointing to both hills, sensing interest starting to build. These two hills on opposite sides of the battlefield are the only outposts where their commanders can direct the combat. That is obvious, squire. Tell us something we do not know, an impatient knight criticized. Blade nervously held up his hand and continued. They know not the range of our double bow. If we but measure the distance to these two hills before the battle, we can use 1,000 archers to shoot as one and cover both rises with a blanket of arrows. He took a breath. Feeling safe at that distance, they will be without shields. 3 quick volleys would most kill or wound all their commanders, causing surprise and lack of leadership in their ranks. The command tent fell silent. No one even coughed as they stared at the map table. Blade started to panic. He should have stayed silent. Blade quickly added, breaking the hush, "This will put 3 volleys of 500 arrows on each hill by a 10 count," and the room erupted. Comments condemning and praising the idea bantered back and forth. The king's commander raised both arms and called for silence. By the saints, 'tis a wild plan, he said, locking eyes at the table. The distance would strain the talent of the new bow. He turned his eyes to Blade. It is not yet battle-tested. Low murmurs of agreement filled the room. But by the heavens, the other plans are not worthy, and no one proposed a better strategy, he declared, glancing around the room. The master bowman stepped forward. Pray, Sir Knight, the plan has merit. My archers are up to the task. Let us give a show to prove. He paused in thought. We will be ready in 4 suns. Blade breathed a sigh of relief for the support, but panicked about their ability to prove the plan in only 4 suns. Twice that would hardly be enough. The rest started muttering and whispering for and against. The king's commander pounded the table, stilling all. Looking at Blade and his commander, he gave his order. Sirs, you have 3 sons. More would hinder our chance of a successful retreat if your plan fails. 3 sons, no more. The test went well. Blade's plan worked. The commanders agreed and preparations were made. 500 archers were assigned to target each hill. They would shoot 3 volleys on command, 5 counts apart, blanketing both hills with 3,000 arrows. It was judged that over 200 high and lesser-ranked commanders would be stationed on the enemy hills, plus bands of flag-bearers, drummers, and runners to relay orders to the advancing army. A launching field was measured and laid out to match the enemy outposts. Target guides were mounted firm in the ground, each angle measured by three in square ranks, a short arm apart, creating a grid, ensuring uniform coverage of the killing ground. Test shots were conducted, and Blade personally instructed each archer. He ordered all to rub ashes on every arrow shaft to match the morning sky. The last task was dipping the arrows in a toxic poison captured from the Saracens in the last campaign. Blade cursed the order, but realized it was necessary to ensure any arrow's scratch caused a quick death. The morn of battle was dull cast and cool. Blade studied the sky, knowing the arrows would be near invisible. The Crusaders, 10,000 strong, stood restless, watching silently as the enemy horde formed on the opposite plain. It seemed their masses were endless. The gray beasts stationed in front ranks were covered with harness of double leather and metal shields. As scouts reported, four archers perched in armored baskets on the animals' backs could shoot down at the Crusaders at close range. For their protection, 20 to 30 lancers circled each beast. A prisoner, captured yestereve and tortured, named them elephants from India as they thundered to position. Blade thought they looked like living castles. Behind the trumpeting gray wall, thousands upon thousands of foot soldiers formed at the ready. The rumble of the pagan army trembled the earth as clanging and dust clouds filled the air. Trumpets sounded and drums beat to quarters while commanders took the expected positions on the two hills. The entourage of flag bearers, trumpeters, and runners crowded in position around the commanders, flaunting arrogant with slow, bold movements, savoring their expected victory. The Master Bowman and Blade watched from a small platform a man high. "I wish we could see their smug faces," the Master muttered. "We will, when they are dead," Blade answered, turning to the archers. "Ready your bows. Breathe deep, with steady hand. Remember, fire only on the green," he boomed, as squad sergeants-at-arms walked among the grid repeating the order. 1,000 men sat down as one, placed the bows around their feet, knocked their arrow, and fixed their position with the target guides. Suddenly, the thunder din of the enemy stopped, and silence sucked the air. The infidels waited for their commander's order to attack, while Sir Death watched from the heavens. To divert the pagans' attention from the arrows, the center of the Crusader army, 6,000 strong, began chanting. When the enemy's eyes centered on them, Blade raised the yellow flag, signaling all archers to make their pull to the arrowheads. 5 counts later, Blade yelled, "Fire!" dropping the green flag. A sucking whoosh filled the air as 1,000 arrows pulled to their barbs left their bows. Yellow flag quick again, green flag dipped, and another 1,000 drops of poison rain filled the air. Another 5 counts, and the last sticks of death sliced through the sky. The first arrow slammed into the enemy command like needles from hell with devastating results. Most were dead or dying as the second curtain of poison sealed their fate. The third was the coup de grace. The Crusaders' cheers matched the enemy's cries of alarm, watching their commanders die before their eyes. Widespread panic and confusion spread through their ranks like wildfire. Truly, the Crusaders commanded arrows from hell. Blade redirected the bowmen to arch their arrows over the elephants, lobbing them into the pagans' legions. Terror and hysteria quickly spread, and the army routed, fleeing the valley. The confused elephants sensed their master's panic and stampeded in all directions, slinging off archers and trampling everything in their path. Their trumpeted fear eerily announced their death march as they crushed the bodies of the barbarians. The Crusaders cheered, and Blade was a hero. As usual, as the sun moved low over the earth, squads were dispatched to inspect the killing ground to survey and report. As they spread out, Blade found himself at the far edge, approaching a small copse of olive trees. Mindful of his sliced heel, he stepped carefully, with bow strung, between the mess of equipment and bodies ever alert for wounded enemy who could still kill. As he remembered the sword slash across his heel, suddenly a muffled clicking sound whirled him around, letting his arrow fly. A dying scream answered the shaft's mark. Advancing cautious, he spotted the arrow, buried in the chest of a Saracen woman. Bending, he looked closer, when a screeching noise erupted under her body, causing him to jump, grabbing his knife. Heart-pumping blade rolled the body over and found an angry infant. His men laughed, and Blade turned red, staring at the screeching babe wrapped in a swaddling cloth. It somehow survived the horror of the morn, protected by the mother, a camp follower trampled by the retreating army. "Well now, Blade, what you find there?" one asked. "Kill the sniveler and be done," another added. Blade, confused, picked it up and held it straight out, stiff-armed. As soon as the baby felt Blade's grip, it stopped crying and returned his stare, confusing Blade even more. "It sure smells like dung," he joked, suddenly aware of the baby's fragile dependence and determined survival. Feeling guilty for killing the mother, he couldn't bring himself to kill the infant. It deserved a chance, so he decided to take it back and give it to a camp follower. Walking along, cradling the babe, he felt awkward and protective at the same time, especially with the teasing of his comrades. Finally, temper flaring with a belly full of jibes, he quieted them with a hard stare. At camp, the doxies turned their back, declaring it a heathen better dead, even with bribes of gold. Angry at their excuses, he finally found a temporary berth after doubling his cost. That done, he returned to duty, mobilizing the army west to the coast and home. After a quarter moon, it was clear the camp tarts were neglecting the baby. At the next village they passed, he took leave, determined, and finally found an older man and woman willing to take the baby boy for a handful of gold. Speaking was difficult, neither understanding the other, but with much gesturing, pointing, and face-twisting, he finally struck a bargain. As best he could, he thought they might be Basque, a mountain people living in a small village called Cima Verde. They seemed kindly, with several of what he supposed were grandchildren hanging on their legs. After they pointed to a nearby church, he figured they were Catholic, a bonus. With a breath of relief and a clear conscience, Blade gave over the baby and coin. As he turned to leave, the old couple started rattling in their tongue, gesturing excitedly, pointing to Blade and the baby. Blade, past due and in a hurry, thought they wanted his name. "Thomas Michael Fallon," he shouted over his shoulder as he trotted away, afraid they might break the bargain as he waved, smiled, nodded, and stepped his pace. After a distance, satisfied and relieved with his good deed, he returned to camp.